The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
We absolutely support Israel's right to defend itself in line with international law.
We need to safeguard financial stability.
2024 is not going to be an easy year.
We used to call it the dream of home ownership, but look at Britain now.
We've got to hang on to optimism and hope because it is the biggest driver of change.
Let's stop thinking of life in terms of Brexit. Let's move on and look to the future.
You're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics. I'm Stephen Carroll.
And I'm Caroline Hepke. Welcome to the programme.
Now, today we're going to be delving into the perhaps fact, perhaps fiction-based world of economic forecasting, or at least some MPs' perspectives on it as well, because the Office for Budget Responsibility has been speaking to MPs in Parliament. So we'll get into that in a moment. But turning from perhaps the imaginary world of economic forecasting to a different sort of game that's gripping MPs in Westminster, who wants to buy the Telegraph Media Group? And it's a list that might be growing.
Bloomberg has learned that Rupert Murdoch's News Corp has held talks with the owner of the Daily Mail about drawing up a bid with the UAE-backed investment fund Redbird IMI. That's as regulators have been considering the current takeover offer from Redbird. Joining us now to discuss is our global business editor, Jamie Nimmo. Welcome to the radio studio. Look, first of all, the talks are at an early stage. What do we know exactly?
Well, just to rewind a little bit, I guess what we, for people who know that Redbird IMI is involved, now that process has dragged on for a while. It's going through government review. Now it seems that the people in the background, the rival bidders, are getting together and talking about how they might be able to approach this should the deal get blocked or get towards that stage. So we've heard that DMGT and News UK, which is Rupert Murdoch's group that owns the Times and the Sunday Times, have held talks about how they might form some sort of joint bid. We don't exactly know what that might look like at this stage. I think, to be honest, neither do they. And these are all, you know, precursors to what will happen in the process that's ongoing as well with Redbird IMI. So it's a little unclear, but what it might do if Redbird IMI is really keen to keep in there is reduce their shareholding to an acceptable level to the government, and that might keep them involved in Telegraph in some form.
Very interesting to watch how that develops as well. The question of Redbird IMI's interest in the Telegraph Media Group got the government involved in this issue last year. What, just the background, what is the issue with them wanting to buy the media group?
Yeah, so critics say no government, no state, foreign state, that is, should have control over any media assets. That's their standing. You know, they're happy with individuals, wealthy individuals to own and be publishers, but they have problems with foreign states owning it. That's the issue that they're coming from. They've got 100 MPs who are saying that they will. You know, they would vote against that. They're against that. So there's growing opposition to that. And
But when it comes to the law around, you know, buying assets in the UK, that isn't particularly imprinted in any of the laws that we have. I mean, there are issues around things that are not in the national interest, for example. But there is also this idea that Rishi Sunak could try to bring some legislation forward. So actually, the kind of laws around buying businesses in the UK are also a bit murky on this point, or undecided on this fact.
Yeah, that's right. When the process started, we were all looking at the regulators and hoping, you know, or looking at them to make the decision, which is probably what the government was doing as well. But as it sort of dragged on, it now looks like the regulatory side is almost irrelevant. And it's when these amendments, you know, come forward, or if they go through, and it looks like they might, that regulatory side, you know, Ofcom's decision and CMA's decision is sort of irrelevant, and then it's up to the government to decide yes or no, basically.
What do we know? What is the sort of the interest in the Telegraph Media Group? Like, what do the investors see in this?
Newspapers don't have the biggest circulation in the world anymore. Why buy a newspaper?
Yeah, it's true, but they are still hugely influential. I mean, the Telegraph, especially on the right of politics. So you've got a Conservative government, you could argue, how long for, but it's still hugely influential in the right. You can see in the last few years, it's even become more vocal and more, you know, more vocal in its headlines and the way it talks and its opinions,
columnists,
columnists especially as well. So it gives them, you know, huge voice. You know, it's still, you know, you could argue a bit like in America, the sort of broadcasters set the agenda. You know, here it's really the newspapers in the morning. The first thing that sets the agenda is the newspaper headlines and the columnists. So you could still argue it's hugely influential.
And yet Abu Dhabi owns other assets in the UK. It doesn't have freedom of the press at all. And so, you know, I suppose, why is this asset different from any other?
Yeah, I think it's just this idea of freedom in the press in the UK that people, the critics, are so worked up about. Yes, they own property, they own football club. Sheikh Mansour owns Man City and Manchester City Football Club, and he's the driving force, or he's the majority owner behind Redbird IMI. But I think it's just this idea that it's controlling the narrative and the voice that people find slightly jarring and unnerving.
So this deal has attracted an awful lot of attention, as you said, not least in Westminster too. There is discussion about perhaps changing the laws around this as well that would make this sort of issue not come up in the same way again. What sort of changes are being considered?
Yeah, so there's talk about a vote potentially in Parliament, and I mentioned those MPs who are against it, so that could be one way. It could be that they bypass that completely and go in a different direction. Not exactly sure what that is yet. It's still unclear. We should probably find out in the next day or two, you know, what those look like. But it should be, you would imagine, quite a straightforward way of the government blocking it. And Baroness Stowell has put forward some amendments in the Digital Markets Bill, but the government's sort of pushing in a slightly different direction, I think, and doesn't want to include that in there. So we'll see where it all plays out.
Yeah. In terms of then those other players, I mean, the one that we haven't mentioned is Paul Marshall of Marshall Wace, who's a big fund manager, very well known in the UK, also owns a good chunk of GB News. Any thoughts on where that sort of jockeying might be? I mean, you know, they're basically all very big, well-known media names kind of trying to get in there.
Yeah, I mean, he is still very interested. I mean, all these guys are still very interested. Mm. What they will all say is that they're, you know, there's a process ongoing and they're just sitting there and waiting and seeing. But really, they are, you know, watching very closely. They're all still very interested. And if that process opened up, Marshall is very much still involved. I mean, he's got Paul Zwillenberg, who was... DMGT's CEO actually advising on this deal,
right.
Which might explain, you know, the reason why they're not involved in this potential deal that we talked about at the start with News UK. He's very much still interested, and of course he's got GB News and Unheard as well. So, you know, he would love to get his hands on the Telegraph still, that's for sure.
What should we be watching out for next in this process?
Yeah, so we've got the amendments, which you mentioned, should be coming up this week. Be interesting to see what's in those. The report that Ofcom and the CMA delivered to DCMS, that's happened. We don't know exactly when we'll see details of that.
Yes.
Could be end of this week, but I think by now we're looking at the amendments and what the government can do, so I think it's a bit of a side issue at this stage.
What is, and I know politics isn't your main bread and butter topic, but what is the view then from the Labour Party or Lib Dems? Would anything similar occur for them, you know, around those influential voices in the media in the UK? Have they got a view?
Yeah, it's a really interesting point, isn't it? Because yesterday it was that Fraser Nelson, the editor of The Spectator, was talking about how Thangam Debonair of the Labour Party was against the deal, and that was widely reported that she was against it. Now, what we've heard actually is that they've sort of rode back on that internally, and, you know, people familiar are saying,
yes,
that, well, actually, you know, we're not really against the deal. They're sort of walking it back. So actually, We're not really sure where the Labour Party stands on this. And by the time that any decision actually goes through, say Redbird, IMI are still involved, by the time a general election comes, which is possible, we still don't really know. It could be up to the Labour Party, and we don't exactly know what they think about this yet.
Because is there any specific timeline on when we might actually get this deal concluded? Because it's been going on for quite a long time already.
Well, exactly. And they had to restart the latest stage of it because of the management change, the structural changes that Redbird IMI, added extra complexity. So, it could... They could decide to stay in and, really stick it out. If it goes to a phase two investigation, which is an in-depth one, that could drag on and on and on. They could walk away and then it could restart the auction process where the other guys get involved.
Well, if there was a revised bid again, that would have to basically reset to zero to examine it.
Yeah, it would restart it. I mean, it depends whether there'd be any sort of... there would be
changes,
competition
suppose, yeah.
authorities involved, obviously, but whether it would involve the same sort of... foreign state ownership review is probably not.
Which may also not be a great conclusion. Britain open for business, the amount of time, even though it's a controversial deal, for actually a decision one way or the other to happen is pretty tricky, isn't it? Jamie, really appreciate you coming into the studio, talking us through the story. That is Bloomberg's global business editor, Jamie Nimmo.
Yeah, and it's one we'll continue to follow for you as well, because it is one of those business stories that crops up quite regularly in the political world as well. And certainly, as Jamie was telling us, an awful lot of interest from MPs as well, particularly in the Conservative Party, as to what happens to the future of the Telegraph Media Group, which of course is the Telegraph newspaper, but also the Spectator as well. The head of the government's independent budget watchdog isn't really supposed to make headlines when he speaks, but back in January, Richard Hughes from the Office for Budget Responsibility responded to criticism of his forecasts by saying that he doesn't get enough information from the government to put them together. He said the government hasn't even bothered to write down what its departmental spending plans are, underpinning the plans for public services. Richard Hughes is back giving evidence to the Treasury Select Committee today, and he was asked if he still stood by that view.
So there continues to be an imbalance between how much detail we have of the government's tax plans, which support its objective of getting debt falling in 5 years' time, and the amount of detail that we have about its plans for departmental spending, which makes up 40% of total public spending on the spending side of the ledger. We know the government's plans for national insurance, we know the government's plans for energy taxation in 5 years' time, but what we know about government's plans for spending on public services runs out after March of next year, and then after that, the government just gives us two numbers to put into our forecast, one for total current spending on public services and one for total capital spending on public services, and no detail about what that means for the National Health Service, what it means for education, what it means for transport. And that poses a significant risk because those envelopes are relatively constrained, they're not growing in real per capita terms. And so what we don't see on the spending side is a plan for living within that relatively constrained envelope while also meeting what the government has also stated, which is objectives to grow certain large elements of public service spending faster than that overall envelope. They've got a workforce plan in the NHS, they've got commitments to grow defence spending in line with GDP, they've got commitments to grow overseas aid spending in line with GDP. They've got ambitions in some of those areas to go even further. How they make that add up with the rest of Whitehall departments, we don't know.
So that was Richard Hughes of the Office for Budget Responsibility there, speaking to MPs, the Treasury Select Committee. Fair to say that he's gotten, or at least the OBR has gotten, a bit of a hard time from MPs about their forecasts. He's trying to explain it there in terms of, I suppose, how do you put these things together?
Look, I think the overall impression from this select committee hearing is that this is, some economists who are working with the data and working with the figures, and they are sort of defending their position. So it highlights the pressure, frankly, that the UK economy is under and just how poorly Britain has done, actually, in the last 15 years, about which these economists are really quite frank and it's bleak. But it also highlights just how much pressure the government is under, because the questions are so pointed about, why the OBR has a difference in forecast to the Bank of England. This is simply the independent body, perhaps one that has been politicised, but it's meant to be the independent body that marks the homework of government. They don't make any of the policies or any of the sort of strategies. And so they are sort of trying to take, interestingly, quite a robust attitude to government, and they're also quite frank about the 15 years of lack of productivity that the UK has seen and just how much poorer that has made Britain, and that a lot of what they're doing is an educated guess. And sometimes, as one of the OBR economists said, you know, it's not even educated. It is, you know, looking at the figures and trying to do the best.
I suppose it sort of speaks to the economic time that we are in, that the OBR is so important. And of course, the other element of this is that it's so factored into how the government has to make its spending decisions of the budget, because it is the OBR forecast that they have to rely on when it comes to the share of debt of GDP, and to have that under the current fiscal rules falling at the end of a 5-year period. So they have to have a somewhat symbiotic relationship, in that one sort of relies on the other for making plans too. And perhaps gives us a bit of an indication that it's just not that easy to make, especially 5-year away predictions when it comes to the economy like the UK.
Yes, absolutely. But I think also that there is this gap, as I say, between the OBR and the Bank of England, I think is really quite interesting, in the sense that they are giving the government a bit of the benefit of the doubt. I mean, on this point, should we bring in our senior economics reporter, Philip Aldrich, on this? I wonder how much of the OBR chat you managed to catch this morning. It's between MPs and the Office for Budget Responsibility. What have we heard so far? I mean, there were questions on all of the hot button issues, weren't they? On debt, on economic growth in the UK, on public services, on immigration. They're under some pressure from MPs.
Yeah, I was just listening to it. I mean, a couple of things which jumped out at me were, obviously, the point that the spending plans, there's just no spending plans, and he's made, that's the fiscal fiction of, you know, post the election. We don't know how the money is going to be spent, but there are all these commitments to increase spending in line with GDP per head for NHS, for defence, but you've got this incredibly tight overall spending envelope. So what does that actually mean for other departments, which are already facing massive cuts? So there was that tension. But he also pointed out that these unfunded spending arrangements are a risk to the public finances, because obviously he says in the past, what happens is when it comes to actually penciling in the numbers, because there hasn't been a spending review, when it comes to penciling the numbers, you see governments tend to add 20 to 30 billion, right? So that's a percent of a percent of GDP added to the spending totals there, which is, if you think about
it,
it's a huge. I mean, if you think about what the giveaway was over two budgets to personal taxes on Nick's cuts, was 20 billion quid. So the suggestion is that as soon as he's confronted with having to actually put the money into the spending envelopes for these departments, he's going to be giving all of that and more back in terms of, you know, that's going to be the increase in spending. So where's he going to get the money from to do that? Is it going to be borrowing? Is it going to be reversing those tax cuts? I mean, it's all kind of make-believe at the moment.
Okay, but so then hang on a second. If it's all make-believe, why is this budget, was it so much more well-received than, let's say, the Liz Truss budget? Well, come on, describe to me how much of a gap there is then between Hunt and Truss and where we are now.
Well, I mean, obviously, because the OBR wasn't in the Truss, involved in the Truss arrangements. And so, I mean, a lot of economics is really imagination. And, you know, when it comes to the spending, you know, when it comes to the public finances and the market reaction to the public finances, the markets want to believe that these are stable, that this is a sensible country. And, you know, we've got a set of forecasts based on fiction, but the markets will tolerate that as long as the official bodies say that this is within the bounds of, you know, bounds of reason.
As long as,
right?
It's official fiction.
Official fiction. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But so you've got, I mean, I like to think that the key figures in terms of who guides the markets here. So the OBR basically sets the tone for the markets. If the OBR gives it a big tick, the markets say, OK, don't need to look at the detail here. We'll just get on with it. We think this is reasonable. Paul Johnson at the IFS, he's the other one in it. If he says things are OK, then the markets will normally accept that. But what obviously happened with Truss is that she said, we're not interested in the OBR. We, you know, we don't even like the Bank of England. We don't like the permanent secretary at the Treasury. I mean, it was a case of all the people that you want to give a nice big green tick to for the markets to believe in were just jettisoned. And so they were like, oh my God. And of course, then Kwasi Kwarteng, after upsetting the markets, then doubled down over the weekend and said, we're going to do even more of this. So that just freaked everyone out.
Is there a point to this criticism of the OBR forecast, though? I mean, are they less accurate than the other sectors of the imagination that you're referring to?
If you're in government, you'd probably look at the OBR and say, thank you very much. They are very generous. They are very optimistic in their forecast compared with others. I mean, the growth forecast they got for this year, 0.8, is double what the Treasury's independent forecast, the collection of independent forecasters that Treasury gathers, is double that. So the dynamic response, so if policy has an effect on GDP, then the government recovers some of the cost of that policy if it's a tax cut, because it gets a little bit of tax back through the extra growth generated. they got a big increase. They got a big upside on that. And like the most striking one was that they announced a cut in capital gains tax for second homes from 28% to 24%. And the OBR said that this would be a tax revenue raising measure, right? So you get an incredibly dynamic response there in terms of the OBR's in the OBR's outlook. So the idea that the OBR is some kind of cruel horror,
archaic, dusting off their abacuses.
Exactly. Is in this particular instance has not been the case. And obviously, what the OBR does is they set a set of forecasts from which you will interpret the government's self-imposed fiscal rules. So they set their rules, and so if they're angry with what the which a lot of Tories are, because they need somebody to blame. Because the fact is, if they want to meet the spending totals, or if they want to get the tax burden down, they have to confront the harsh reality that it involves extraordinarily difficult decisions. Debt interest costs have gone up by 60 billion quid a year compared with pre-pandemic rates. That is the entire defence budget that's just been added to public spending, and you get nothing out of it. And you can't live with that higher level of debt servicing unless you have higher tax rates or you have lower spending. I mean, you have to make a decision there. But obviously, what a lot of Tory MPs would like is for the OBR just to come up with some absolutely fantastical growth rate which resolves the problem.
But then you've got basically the questions on both sides. Are you fit for purpose? Is the OBR fit for purpose? Because on the one hand, you might have critics who say, look, we want even better out of the OBR and even more sympathetic data. And then for those who might, you know, be less on the Tory side, the inclination to say that the forecasts are so out of whack with city economists or the Bank of England, you know, that they can be interpreted that way, that also it's not fit for purpose. So the OBR sort of stuck in the middle. I mean, is that a good place actually for the Office for Budget Responsibility to be in, frankly, pleasing absolutely no one?
Well, equal opportunities offender is, yes, you know, I suppose you're doing the right thing. It's like journalists, if you've pissed everyone off, then
yes,
probably right.
Another piece of the economic puzzle that we've had today has been the new labour market figures as well, showing what economists would describe as cooling in the labour market. Essentially, the unemployment rate's gone up a little bit, and there've been more, there are fewer jobs on offer as well. Is this a sign of a bigger shift? Is this the sort of thing that tells us something important about the jobs market here?
There's one data point in there which was quite, would, if you were looking for things to see, oh, things are flashing red here, was the big increase in the redundancy rate. So in the space of 3 months, that's doubled.
Which is people losing their jobs, right?
So it is notifications of redundancies from employers. And it doesn't capture small businesses. I mean, there's certain
limits
parameters.
To the data,
but
sure.
But what's happened is the redundancy rate went from, I think it was just over two to just over four per thousand. It's still relatively low historically, so it's not like something to get too worried about. But we've had 3 months of the number of redundancies rising quite sharply. So that might be a sign. You have obviously seen wages come in slightly below forecast. That is still extraordinarily high compared with pre-pandemic norms. Unemployment did tick up. Inactivity. You know, there's still these issues about too many people who are not working, who are not wanting work. But you have definitely seen signs of loosening in the labour market, which should encourage the Bank of England to think more actively about rate cuts.
Every economist and think tank and Labour also seem to be forecasting this kind of long, dismal spell then for the UK economy. Looking at the jobs numbers, as you say, like the inactivity number, the little uptick in redundancies and so on, is it that bad? And also listening to the OBR, I mean, they're not upbeat when they're speaking to MPs about the state of sort of big picture the UK economy. Is it
well
that bad?
I mean, it's hard not to be a bit downbeat, because the last 15 years have been pretty dreadful. I mean, Richard Hughes and David Miles, to the members of the Budget Responsibility Committee at the OBR, said we're talking about the productivity crisis that we've had for the last 15 years. And it was like, had things continued as they were, our GDP would be 30% larger today.
That is a huge number.
Yeah.
30%.
But we're not alone in this. I mean, every country post-financial crisis, the financial crisis reset the global economy. And we were living on hot air prior to the financial crisis, which basically was part of the reason things were, unsustainable. But it's certainly the case that the UK's had a slightly worse situation than others, and so it isn't easy to be sort of positive. But
highly ironic that you should be sitting here being so glum about it, considering you went out and found all of the optimistic people about the British economy.
We found all six of them. Yeah. There are definitely reasons to be more optimistic now, because you've got all the, you know, just on the consumer spending side, you've got. A minimum wage going up, you've got wages still rising as of today, over 6%. You've got a pension, the state pension going up 8.5%. You've got benefits going up, all of these above inflation level. So you've got more spending power. The living standards story is quite positive from here onwards. If you're looking forwards, if you're looking backwards, it's still got a bit of catch up to do. But there are some good reasons to think that things are turning around. And as David Miles did say,
he talked
about artificial intelligence and how that was going to basically, if anything is going to help boost our productivity, that is something to cling on to.
Is this to borrow a political anthem moment and say things are going to get better? Is that basically what you're telling me?
We need a new version of that.
Answers on a postcard. Who wants to pick the next political anthem?
In an era
where
we have to mine all past creativity, to come up with songs and art and so on these days. Lovely stuff. Look, Philip, thank you so much for being with us, as ever. Our senior economics reporter, Philip Aldrich.
Well, that is it from us for today. If you like the programme, don't forget to subscribe. Give it 5 stars so other people can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
This episode was produced by James Walcock and Mia Dawkins, and our audio engineers were Maruful Hussain and Sean Guastamacchia. I'm Caroline Hepke.
And I'm Stephen Carroll. We'll be back with more tomorrow. This is Bloomberg.
Bloomberg UK Politics. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum, powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.